around 1839 when the apprenticeship system was finally abolished. The apprenticeship system had replaced slavery in what originally happened over a course of many decades, is that initially the slave trade itself was made illegal, but it was still legal to have slaves. You just weren't allowed to trade in slaves. Slavery itself only became illegal much later. Even then, slaves were released, but they were still held in apprenticeship, which basically meant they still weren't being paid, and they were still doing exactly the same as they were doing before, but they were no longer called slaves. And it was in 1838 that finally came to an end as a result of pressure from the organisation and from its political supporters. And so essentially at that point, what the organisation decided it needed to do was to expand that out to all nations rather than just Britain and the colonies. And that's where the notion that human rights came into it, in as much as regardless of the laws of any particular country, if they were trading in slaves, if slavery was still legal, then that was considered to be unacceptable. And so that's where the notion of human rights comes into it. And since then, the organisation has worked more or less ceaselessly to address instances of slavery, forced labour, that occur. There are lots of examples there about the situation in the Congo under Leopold II, but there were lots of instances in terms of, say, the British Empire itself, in terms of coolie labour in the Far East, which were opposed. And the organisation exists to eliminate slavery, but at the end of the day, slavery is not something that really can ever be eliminated. It will always exist. But for each generation or each time period, the ways in which slavery manifests itself will be different. And so basically each generation will come across instances of slavery which people need to stand up and say, well, no, that's not right, that's wrong. And it's never really ever going to go away, even though that's what we're committed to doing, and our current statutes say that we're basically working towards the elimination of slavery. But actually what it really means in practice is that at any given time where slavery can be seen to be being practiced, we oppose it and we encourage everybody else to oppose it. And that's more or less what we do and have done ever since days of Clarkson. The reason why slavery cannot, in a sense, be ended, in the same way as you can't eliminate crime, it's something that will always happen where people see the opportunity for it to happen. What is important about slavery is that it exists and will always exist where a range of factors come together to make people exploitable. And that's to do with the vulnerability of the individuals themselves. In terms of modern slavery, everybody who is enslaved is pretty much entirely, in one way or another, they are vulnerable. They are vulnerable because of their age. In the case of children, child labour, they're vulnerable because of poverty more than anything else. They are vulnerable because they're uneducated, and everything else that basically means that they are able to be exploited. Now, that on its own isn't enough. What it also requires is basically a lack of action from the governments and the authorities which are supposed to be there to protect them. In that most countries, pretty much all countries, members of the United Nations, sign up to the United Nations Charter. The United Nations Charter says that slavery is illegal and shouldn't happen. There's a very big gap to signing up to the idea that slavery shouldn't happen and actually doing anything about it whenever it manifests itself. That lies at the heart of the problem in the history of the abolition movement in Britain. it still continues, in that we've only recently actually introduced a law which defines what slavery is and enables prosecution for it. Lots of countries which have abolished slavery, it is still possible to practice slavery because there aren't precise definitions as to what constitutes the enslavement of another person. The original definition which came about through the, through the League of Nations in 1926, which anti-slavery was instrumentally kind of getting put down in writing, relates to the ownership of a person. If one person exercises ownership over another person, then that person is enslaved. But ownership is something which is very difficult in any legal terms to actually define. You know, as economies get more sophisticated, as societies get more sophisticated, there are many ways in which ownership can actually be exercised without it appearing to involve slavery. But the way we look at it is from the point of view of the person who is being controlled and is vulnerable as a result of that, it doesn't make any difference. You know, whether it's classic slavery where you take somebody from one place and you stick them in chains and you put them on a boat and you take them somewhere else and you force them to work. That's kind of obvious and everybody can see that. Today, the same thing still occurs, but usually in much more subtle ways. And the key point is that basically where people are vulnerable, there's always a potential for that to happen. So if we take the example, one of the key areas that we work on at the moment, domestic work, which is basically child domestic work and migrant domestic work, where people can be hugely vulnerable, both in this country and also elsewhere, because of the way the laws work. For many years now, you know, we've been having this kind of conflict with the government over issues around the domestic work visa. The idea that a domestic worker can be brought into the country or can work in the UK, but they're tied to an employer. That they have a kind of work status which is linked to the employer that has brought them into the country. And otherwise, they're not allowed to work in the UK and they don't have any rights. And so if they leave their employer or attempt to leave their employer, they immediately become illegal immigrants. Which at the moment, even though the government is currently talking about basically setting up a slavery commissioner and all kinds of stuff like that, and it's very positive in some senses, in areas where immigration is involved, they are very sensitive and don't really regard the possibility of slavery as being enough to divert them from a broader policy in relation to immigration and work status. But in other countries, exactly the same situation is much worse. So if you look at the Gulf states in particular, most Gulf states have something which is referred to broadly as the kafala system, where the migrant domestic workers are tied to an employer. In most of the Gulf, those domestic workers will be coming from places like Bangladesh, the Philippines, Ethiopia, poor, vulnerable people who are one way or another encouraged to migrate to the Middle East because they're going to get loads of work, jobs great, and everything else. What happens when they arrive? The laws in most Gulf states basically require the employers to take away the worker's passport, to basically not allow them to leave the house unless they're accompanied. You end up with a situation where most domestic workers in, say, places like the Lebanon, effectively are locked in the house whenever everybody else leaves the house. All their documentation is removed. For the most part, they don't get paid. And they don't get paid on the excuse that is a disincentive for them to run away and basically leave their employer. What they find themselves in is pretty much a classic situation of slavery, that their freedom has been removed, that they have no contact with their families, they're not allowed to leave their household unless they're accompanied, they're not actually being chained up, but it's the same difference. They have no rights, they have no status, and as often as not, they're not even being paid. So in effect, they are enslaved. In fact, there was a report that was produced for the, I think, the Ministry of the Interior in Lebanon in 2010, seeking to refute the idea that domestic workers were vulnerable. And the report actually said that if they felt they were being mistreated or exploited, the domestic workers could report their owners to the authorities, which is in itself admitting that as far as the society is concerned, they see those domestic workers as being owned. Essentially, the problem with that situation is that it's completely unregulated. These are effectively workers who are living in people's houses. For the most part, they're not even considered to be working in any real sense. They're having a house and that they are being provided for as a result of that. And the argument generally tends to go, well, they're better off here than they would be in Bangladesh, wherever. Actually, that isn't really the case at all. The reality is that many, many domestic workers attempt to kind of flee the situations they're in. The number of suicides that occur are phenomenal. But actually, a lot of those suicides are, in effect, people who die trying to escape from the houses because they're being locked in these houses. And what they do is they jump out of windows and they die in the process. And it's basically a situation where, really, for the individuals concerned, their status, their quality of life, what they are experiencing is very little different to what we would understand as being classic slavery, which would have been experienced by slaves right throughout history. With the added problem with something like, or the added issue with something like domestic work, is obviously 95% of the domestic workers are women, and issues of sexual abuse and sexual harassment and physical violence are basically commonplace. And, you know, well over a quarter of all domestic workers, migrant domestic workers, are physically or sexually abused on a routine basis. And 80% of them have their wages withheld to prevent them leaving their employers. And the situation is even worse for child domestic workers, which effectively is less of a kind of migrant worker issue, but occurs. Most countries have internal domestic worker setups, and, you know, throughout Africa, throughout Asia, Latin America, it's basically common practice, traditional, even for, you know, within poor communities, for children to basically go and work in the house of a rich relative or somebody who says, well, you know, I'll look after the kid and the kid can just work for me. Millions and millions of children are in those kinds of situations, which sometimes isn't, you know, in theory, there is a logic to the practice. The children are so vulnerable, and the situation they're in is so vulnerable, that the amount of exploitation, the amount of abuse which then occurs is outrageous. And then even at a kind of standard level, most of those children, because they're working 16, 18 hours in the household, they're unable to go to school. Their future is being taken away from them as a result of the decision to place them in a household. Now, as far as we're concerned, that's slavery. Those children don't have any say in that. That they have absolutely no ability to oppose or to question the decisions that are made on their behalf. And their lives are ruined as a result. And the amount of psychological harm that it causes, particularly where they're being physically abused or mentally abused and generally ignored and neglected within the household, is basically something which they can never recover from. And what we try and do is advocate with national governments and with the local authorities to recognise that these children are working, and that as such they have the same rights as any other worker, and that where they are being mistreated, where they are being denied all the things which in theory they're entitled to, like the right to education. Again, most of the countries, that's in their statutes, that compulsory education at primary level. Very few child domestic workers actually get the opportunity to receive that. And so it's about, for us, it's a problem which you can't necessarily do away with. You can't stop child domestic work, because the levels of poverty are such that it is something which is going to happen. So what it's actually about, it's about recognising children are potentially vulnerable, and recognising that their situation needs to be monitored, and recognising that regardless of the fact that they're working in somebody else's household, they still have a right to go to school. And if they are able to go to school, they are then in an environment where if they feel like they need to discuss their problems and what's happening to them in their households, they can. So we do a lot of work around domestic work, child domestic work in particular. And the ILO statistics sort of talk about 21 million, or thereabouts, people being in slavery, which is the figure we endorse. But actually, it's the tip of an iceberg, in as much as the UN will only use figures which it can definitively quantify. It knows that the real situation is much worse than that. And, you know, you can multiply it however many times. That's the figure we use. But more or less about 40-50% of those people who are defined as being in slavery will be children, because they are the most vulnerable. And there are lots of other examples where children in particular exploited. Cases of child soldiers, which occurs in lots of Africa in particular, lots of countries in West Africa and Central Africa. It's a reality for a lot of people. And in Asia, where probably, aside from domestic work, the biggest focus that we have is on bonded labour. In terms of the ILO statistics, bonded labourers are the communist form of enslaved workers. Now, the issue with bonded labour is what tends to happen is that the male head of a household will incur a debt, or will take on a debt to meet medical expenses, to pay for a funeral, any number of reasons. Basically, because their poverty is such, this will happen. Now, they give their labour in payment of the debt or in payment of the loan. And the system is such that they can work their own entire lives and never, ever repay the debt. The debt gets passed down through generation to generation. And for very, very little money at all, a person can find themselves working their entire lives for somebody else. But it's not just them that work. Their wives work, their children work. And so, you know, we have a project in the Punjab working in brick kilns. And on average, for every male worker in the brick kiln who is a bonded labourer, there will be four other immediate family members who are also working in those brick kilns. And that will involve children, as young as three or four. But statistically, only the male head of the household is recognised as being a worker. His family is just there with him, but they're all working. Because in the brick kilns, all the bonded labourers work on a piece rate, and the piece rate is such that they cannot even earn enough to live, well, subsist within the kiln environment, unless every member of their family is helping out in terms of what it is, that the number of bricks which they're supposed to mould in a day. The figures for the number of workers who are in debt bondage in South Asia is a fraction of the number of people who are actually working and have no choice but to work as a result of the systems which exist. And this is where it becomes slightly closer to the kinds of types of enslavement which we would come across, say, in the UK with migrant workers, is that in India, in the Punjab, the majority of the workers in the brick kilns are migrating from other states. They're going to the Punjab from Bihar, Orissa, poorer states, and effectively what is happening is they're being recruited in their home communities and they're being given a loan, and well, basically an advance on their wages, which they need to travel to the Punjab to get the work in the kilns. They work an entire season, which is usually about 8 or 9 months, in the brick kilns, and they'll end up still in debt at the end of the season, which means basically they then have to go back the next year, and their families go back and everything else. And it's a cyclical thing, because the whole family is wrapped up in that, that none of the members of the family have any possibility of escaping from it. And, well, the bizarre thing is, well, bizarre, that bonded labour is now illegal in India and Nepal, Pakistan, as a result of, you know, the work that our partners have been doing with the government, advocating for changes in the law and that kind of thing. It's actually quite easy, in inverted commas, to release a worker from bondage. All you have to do is basically take the work to court, explain your situation in front of a magistrate, and they say, yeah, this worker is in debt bondage, and basically that, you know, that debt is removed. But the problem is they still need to work. Debt bondage in India is almost entirely focused on scheduled castes, scheduled tribes, Dalits primarily, and the society itself basically limits the opportunities that they have, what they can do. They have no choice year on year but to go back to work in the same kilns, for the same agricultural employers. And you can release them from debt bondage, but it's much more difficult to break the system, which is quite depressing in terms of bonded labour. The future lies in enabling people to assert their rights, their rights to education as children, their rights to benefits. So in the case of the workers in the brick kilns, for example, the women who are working alongside their husbands, they're not earning a wage, they're not recognised as workers, so they don't get maternity benefits, they don't get any of the entitlements or benefits which would normally apply to most of the regular workforce. So effectively what we try to do in all cases, whether talking about domestic work, whether we're talking about forms of bonded labour, is to basically get the labour laws which apply to the mainstream population applied to the people who are enslaved. That requires the governments effectively saying, yeah, these people have exactly the same rights as everybody else. And that tends to be where the problem is, that in all countries it's the people who have influence, who have the power, who basically control the legislation. And that's, you know, it's not dissimilar to the situation with the colonial slavery. The situation of the slaves existed because they were coming from places where they weren't recognised as citizens. They have no citizenship rights, so that when they're taken across to the West Indies or have you, they are without rights. That's the root of their vulnerability. What the abolition movement was doing was trying to say, no, that's not the case. These people have to have rights. They have to be covered by the legislation that covers everybody else. When trafficked people come to the UK or end up in the UK, what we're trying to do is to assert their rights. That basically, because they have found themselves, through no particular wish of their own, in the UK, that basically they need to be treated in exactly the same way as anybody else that is in the UK would expect to be treated. So another of the projects which we run is focused on trafficking into criminal exploitation. And the focus of that is basically Vietnamese, mainly Vietnamese children, adolescents, who are basically brought to the UK and they work in cannabis factories, which are basically just houses. They're stuck in these houses and they tend cannabis plants. That's it, they never leave those houses. Their lives are completely blighted. They're not being paid to do this, they're being basically brought in. They're being locked up in these houses and being told to look after these cannabis plants. And the reason why that is because whenever the police raid the cannabis factories, they arrest these Vietnamese trafficked people and essentially deport them. Or certainly they lock them in jail first and then they deport them. These people are victims. They're not criminals. Victims end up being criminalised. And another example, classic example of forced labour would be, say, in Uzbekistan. The cotton harvest in Uzbekistan every year is picked by school children. The government shuts the schools, all the children have to go and work in the cotton fields for the duration of the cotton harvest. Don't get paid for that. State forced labour. They've got away with it for years, simply because Uzbekistan is geopolitically important. The EC doesn't raise it as an issue and it retains all its trade preferences and everything else. So you end up with a situation where basically lots of the clothes which are being retailed on the high streets of, you know, the UK, elsewhere in Europe, are being made with Uzbekistan cotton, which is being picked by forced labour. The international community has very little ability to actually do anything about that. The ILO, for example, has been trying for years to get into Uzbekistan to inspect the cotton harvest every year. The Uzbek authorities simply say no. And that's it. There's nothing specifically they can do about it unless governments, who have the power to do so, wish to kick up a fuss. But in the case of Uzbekistan, they don't. This year, for the first time, not least due to kind of lots of lobbying on our part, the ILO did have limited access to the cotton harvest. Last year, for the first time, because of the kind of outcry, particularly that we created with the US State Department, they started using adult forced labourers rather than children. They still shut the schools, but they told the teachers they had to go and pick the cotton harvest. Instances like that will always exist, and it's about people standing up and saying, that's not acceptable, that's not right in this day and age, and needs to be opposed. And effectively, it's possible to abolish things like that, to eliminate. I'm sure that within a few years, the Uzbekistan cotton crop will no longer be picked by forced labour. But by that point, there'll be something else to deal with. When you look at slavery as an issue of rights, as an issue of ownership, as an issue of coercion, and people's liberty being removed, there are all number of examples that really qualify as slavery but aren't seen as being slavery in the traditional sense. So another area which we're beginning to work on much more is forced marriage. In a lot of the communities where we're working, when very, very young women from the ages of 13 upwards are married off to people and spend a lifetime with somebody that they don't want to be with. They are enslaved. And it happens within the legal frameworks which exist within their countries, even though their countries, in principle, are opposed to slavery. It's a question of how you define it. It depends on how your law defines what constitutes the removal of liberty by one person of another person. And so that's what we do.